This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. You've been listening to Counterspin, and coming up next at 6 o'clock, it's Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs, right here on KBOO. This evening on Bread and Roses, we have local author Liz Prado and publisher Laura Stanfill. They're here to talk about sisterhood in the writing world, so stay tuned.
Hi, jazz lovers. This is Mike. I wanted to tell you about my new podcast that just went live on KBOO website. It's called Unsung Heroes of Jazz, where every week we'll feature an artist who recorded between the 1940s and the 1960s, so-called golden era of jazz, but for whatever reason never really got the recognition they so richly deserved. We'll tell you a little bit about them, play some of their music. Some of them you will have heard of, some of them you won't, but in all cases, they certainly deserve more recognition than they got. We think it's a different wrinkle, and we hope you'll enjoy it, and really hope you'll join us. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 12th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema in Portland. PDX Pop Now includes a record fair, street fair, and two outdoor stages with performers such as Amber Moon, Blue Cranes, Long Knife, Mike Crenshaw, Nurses, The Stops, and many more. That's PDX Pop Now, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Esperanza Spalding, presenting her new project, Emily's De-Evolution, next Tuesday at the Crystal Ballroom. Esperanza Spalding tickets available at crystalballroompdx.com and at the box office the night of the show. And this program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven cooperative striving to provide access to Whole Foods customers can trust. People's features farm direct organic produce, bulk foods, a weekly year-round farmers market, and everyone is welcome. Located on Southeast 21st and Tibbetts Street between Division and Powell. More information at peoples.coop.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs, on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio program in the country. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz, and our engineers are Brooke and Michelle. Tonight, we welcome Portland author, editor, and writing instructor, Liz Prado, here to talk about her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire, published by Press 53. And later in the show, Liz will engage us in a discussion about building relationships and synergy among women in the writing world and the ways we can and do support each other. For that, we'll be joined by Laura Stanfill, the founder and publisher of Portland-based woman-fueled Forest Avenue Press. Liz Prado is an award-winning writer of fiction and nonfiction. Her short stories and essays have appeared in over 24 literary journals and magazines, including Hayden's Fairy Review, The Rumpus, Iron Horse Literary Review, and Salon. She was the guest prose editor for the summer 2013 issue of Voice Catcher and edited the fiction anthology The Night and the Rain and the River for Forest Avenue Press in 2014. She teaches writing at the Attic Institute and several literary organizations throughout Oregon. She's currently writing a memoir. Liz's debut short story collection, Babies on Fire, really delivers on every level. Her characters are real and refreshingly stripped of ego. We often meet them in the aftermath of personal catastrophe, humbled by life, humanized, wide open, and vulnerable. Liz Prado puts these characters in complicated relationships, interesting scenarios, and diverse global settings that come alive. And the dialogue is truly outstanding, and the pages drip with dark humor. Liz Prado's stories deliver throughout, and often profoundly at the close. The endings surprise and illuminate deep human truths. Her stories are everything you want a short story to be. They capture a glimpse of this shared human experience and pass on some hard-won wisdom to help us live a little bit better while we're here. Welcome, Liz Prado.
Hi, thank you.
Congratulations on your debut.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such an exciting time.
I bet. So, Liz, I'm just curious. You've edited collections for others.
Yes.
And I'm curious of what it was like for you to gather your stories together, and how did you make decisions about what stories you wanted to put in the collection?
Well, when I first started thinking about putting together a short story collection, I really didn't know what a short story collection was, in the sense that I just assumed an author took all their published short stories and put them together and sent them out, and that's what that constituted. And then, you know, it started occurring to me that there's usually themes or... themes. There's usually something bigger going on. And so I really started thinking about my collection in terms of that. What are the themes? What are the tones? What kind of feeling do I want a reader to have when they've turned that last page, not just of each story, but of the collection itself? And so I started thinking about it in terms of that. But that being said, my publisher and my editor, Kevin Morgan Watson at Press 53, had a lot to say about that. You know, I sent in the manuscript and there were some stories in there that he didn't like and he pulled them out, which I actually found, in a way, even though it was a bummer that they were pulled out, I also found it very complimentary, in the sense that he found enough that he liked in my manuscript and in the stories that he did read that he was confident that they could stand even if we pulled these other ones out. And then he said, well, what else do you have? And so I sent him some other stories and we worked on one in particular together to pull the collection together. And he's the one who chose the order, ultimately, that the stories went in. So it was a collaborative process.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think it does convey overall, now that you've seen your stories put together in this way?
Yeah, you know, it feels a little vaguer to me now than it did when I felt like I was trying to figure that out 2 years ago or 3 years mm-hmm. ago or whatever. You know, I'm a huge believer in the redemption narrative, though. I think there's these moments of grace that we can always strive for in every situation, even in the worst situations in our lives. We can strive for these moments of grace. I mean, ultimately, I want us to strive for moments of grace, you know, in the best of situations, but that's easy to do, and that's not a story. So I think if I had to really come up with what these stories are about, Steve Almond, in his blurb of my book, said, what did he say? Something like, I will find this, I promise, that the eternal possibility of mercy is what he thought my stories brought together. And he said it better than I could have, I think.
Can you introduce us to some of the characters and stories that you've included in your anthology?
Oh, okay. Wow. I never thought of doing that before. Well, all but one story in the anthology has a female protagonist, which wasn't even necessarily a conscious choice when I first started writing stories. I happened to be working on a novel years and years ago that had a male protagonist and mostly male characters. And so I think it was just natural that when I was going to this other forum at the same time, I was wanting to turn towards female characters. But then when I started thinking about the themes of the anthology, I realized, well, that's one of them. Yeah, these women are, you know, being placed in these circumstances that are testing them. So I have my youngest character is a 15-year-old girl named Shelby who has been sent to stay on a farm in Big Springs, Nebraska, while her parents are splitting up, while her dad is moving out of the house. I have young women who are struggling in different kinds of relationships. There's Lori, who's visiting Tikal in Guatemala with her boyfriend. And while she's there, finds out that her stepmother is dying of cancer. We have Caroline and Sabrina in two different stories. They interact with the same man, this man named Court. And it's about, you know, their different kinds of the ways they're coming into that relationship with him and bouncing off of him. And there's a young, the title story, Babies on Fire, is about a young woman who has just graduated from college and she can't find a job and her boyfriend has cheated on her. And so she moves back home because she's super, super depressed. And she arrives home to find out that her family home has burned down. So those are some of the characters. None of that sounds fun, does it? Sounds kind of.
You know, I really, really enjoyed and savored this collection, and some themes emerged, and you write beautifully about relationships, especially the brother-sister relationship and the father-daughter. And
which is interesting because I didn't have great father-daughter relationship or great brother-sister relationship. So I've often wondered if writing about those is a way of being able to live out this thing that I didn't get to have.
Mm-hmm. I think we're all fed a myth of what it should be.
Yeah.
And writers often, yes, they write what they didn't have or experience. Yeah. Yes. You know, I have to say, as I read the collection, it was as much as I was having a visceral experience and feeling stuff from these very real characters and these complicated scenarios, I also was aware of the craft that you employ in your stories. Mm. And I know you've admittedly said you've studied writing seriously. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, in your words, what do you think makes a great short story? Mm. And what do you strive for when you start one?
Mm. Well, what makes a great short story? I mean, there's so many ways to answer that question, but and this may sound really straightforward, but you'd be amazed how many writers don't get this, is a complete story arc. Something has happened. And that doesn't mean, like, you know, birth to death or, you know, but there has to be, like, something that's actually traveled an arc. And when I was editing both for Voice Catcher and for The Night and the Rain and the River, I got a lot of short stories that were just anecdotes or, they didn't have anything at risk. They didn't have the character in any kind of emotional peril. They didn't have, they were just hard to care about. So what I'm going for is I want characters in peril. I want characters the reader can care about. And I don't mean that just in terms of likability. I don't mean like, oh, they want to go out and have coffee with that person. I mean someone they can be sympathetic to. Somebody they can recognize, oh, that person had their heart broken in this way, oh, this person is experiencing death or loss or self-doubt or addiction or whatever those things are. And so for me, that's one thing I strive for, is I want there to be that kind of identification and sympathy, and yet push it just beyond that so that people can also feel a compassion for someone who's not like them necessarily.
Mm-hmm. And I have to talk about your endings.
Okay.
As part of this craft conversation, you know, I won't give anything away, but more than once at the end, I was astonished, you know,
thank you.
It was interesting. As I read your stories, you know, you're not a pretentious writer. Your characters aren't pretentious. So I would be having this experience of reading this, and I don't mean this negatively at all, but like a simple human story. Yeah. And then this ending would happen. And I was suddenly like, catapulted into this profound awareness of something you'd done very sophisticatedly throughout. You weave, you set us up for this ending, and we don't expect it. And it really takes your breath away. And I wondered if that's something that you learned, and if that's something you teach your students, how to have those moments with the reader.
Yeah, I think with every short story, it's really important to read the ending. Like, you know, after you've written it and, you know, you're revising it, you're working on it, you're trying to figure out what's going on, and just read the ending and then read the first page and see, are they having a conversation with each other at all? Because if they're not, there's a missed opportunity there probably. So, yes, I try and convey that. And that's something I learned. Everything I know I've learned, and everything I've learned, I try and pass on to other writers. You know, it's not like this, you know, gold, you know, treasure that you're supposed to keep to yourself and you're not supposed to pass on. I mean, that's what hopefully we're all doing as writers, is passing along what we know to other people so they can continue to perpetuate the art. Because what we really care about is the art. So we want people to be making that art and have the tools to the art as much as possible. Yeah,
writers need people to inspire them.
Yeah. Did that answer your question?
No, actually. Give me the secret. That's what I want.
Well, I mean, seriously, the secret is read short stories and mm-hmm. look at the endings and really examine, how did that author get there? Mm-hmm. I think one of the best endings to a short story in all of fiction is the end of Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin. And it is transcendental. I mean, it really just lifts you up off the page and gives a new light to the entire story, everything that you've just gone through. It ties it together. It doesn't tie it together in the way that you know everything is going to be okay, because you don't necessarily know that. But you know, in that moment, everybody is okay. In that moment, Sonny is safe. His brother is safe. Creole is safe. In that moment, it's all okay. That's a good short story ending.
You're listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO. Our guest tonight, Portland-based author Liz Prado. We're here celebrating her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire. Liz, would you be willing to read for us now?
Sure, I'd love to. Okay. So I am going to read from the one story that doesn't have a female protagonist. That's weird. I don't know why I decided that. But honestly, I had a hard time finding a story to read because there's lots of sex and drugs and language in here. And the FCC doesn't like that stuff. So I really had to find one that didn't have too much of that going on.
Sorry.
Anyway, this is Minor League Lessons with my male protagonist. My grandmother floored the accelerator on the golf cart. It only had a top speed of 20 miles per hour, but I still clutched the edges of the vinyl seat. She aimed us toward the front doors of Anasazi Meadows, where her fellow residents were being helped into a minivan amid a quagmire of walkers and wheelchairs. It was Sunday afternoon, and thank God the kids I coached had no practice and no game. I'd been screaming at them a lot lately. Plant your back foot. Stick up your elbow. Follow through on the ball. Don't stand flat-footed. This isn't Little League. Even I was tired of hearing me scream. They were just 16 and 17-year-old guys who wanted to be playing some stupid video game or splashing around in the pool or smoking weed in the backseat of a car, and some washed-up third-rate ball player was skinning their asses. An 8-1 record, my bimby said? I bet no one else in this joint has a grandson whose team has an 8-1 record. She made it sound like it was impressive that coaching high school was the only job I could land. There was a scout at that last game, I said. A middle-aged man in the bleachers who was no one's dad. They've got a couple of kids on their radar. Bimby made a sharp turn toward the activity center. That's all well and good, Jason, but maybe you should show them what you can do with a long ball. My professional baseball career had ended in a coke-fueled disgrace 8 years earlier, but Bimby still grasped onto the insane hope that some team would suddenly want me to suit up and take third. Anasazi Meadows was pretty compact, so our weekly tours retraced a lot of the same real estate. When I used to visit Bimby at Sepulveda Terrace in California, she'd drive us through the 9-hole golf course and show me green-necked ducks in the pond. We'd stop by her friends' apartments for lemon cake and Arnold Palmer's. At Anasazi Meadows, there was no one to visit. Hardly anything to see, just us doing circles through the arid air. But it was better than last winter when Bimby just sat in her lazy boy, wrapped in some terrible quilt, watching the 24-hour news. That was the worst part about moving her to Santa Fe after Pop died last year. I was her last living family member, and vice versa. But the cold weather made her poor old joints ache. Are you still dating that skinny girl? Bimby asked. Basically, I said. We'd only been seeing each other for 1 month, and Tony was too young, 22 to my 32, and it was too soon after Pilar dumped me for anything serious. She's a bad influence, Bimby said. What am I, 14? You always smell like reefer when you come from her place, Bimby said. What are you talking about? I do not, I said. I hadn't seen Tony yet that day, but was still relieved sunglasses hid my pupils. My last stint in rehab was 18 months ago, and Bimby and I had a deal. If I started using again, off to rehab I'd go. And besides, I said, how would you know what reefer smells like? I lived through the 60s, you know, Bimby said. She ran a stop sign just as a bent-over woman stepped off the sidewalk. The woman teetered back. Sorry, Teresa, Bimby yelled. Then she said to me, maybe that skinny girl's after your money. That's pretty unlikely, I said. I didn't have that kind of dough, unlike most trust fund babies in Santa Fe. My recent inheritance had trickled down from a man who spent his entire life selling refrigerators and stoves in San Bernardino, hoping his son would make it in the bigs one day. Of course, there would have been more money if Pop hadn't paid off my debts and footed the bill for 2 tours through the Santa Fe Recovery Center. Relapse is a part of recovery, my counselors used to say, like that was reassuring. Bimby brought the golf cart to a stop at the Anasazi Meadows sign. Retirement living for today and tomorrow. One left turn out of there and we'd be on Paseo de Peralta, and a mile or so later heading south on I-25. What do you say, Bambino? She said. She smiled crinkled coral lips. You and me on a beach in Mexico? The sun was dropping, making pinon trees dissolve behind lazy orange clouds. Beyond the saffron horizon, I saw myself covered in sand, with tequila and salt water licking my limbs. I nodded toward Paseo. Go for it, I said.
Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome.
That was Portland author Liz Prado reading from her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire. That excerpt was from Minor League Lessons. And that's a good example of what we were talking about. I won't try not to get anything away. I'm sorry if I do. But, you know, the minor league lessons, the things he learned in baseball, have a lot to say about addiction and life that you weave into that story. I like all the things happening on all the different levels.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, in addition to fiction, you write nonfiction. I mentioned earlier you're working on a memoir.
Completed a memoir, actually.
Yeah. Anything you want to say about that?
It's a memoir about the 4 or 5 year period of time during which my adult brother and my elderly father, who were living 1,000 miles away, both descended into mental and physical illness. And it's about my struggle with trying to be a good daughter and trying to set boundaries and save myself. And they ultimately both died and I had a breakdown. And so it was about really understanding what it meant to lose my whole family, because my mother was already deceased. What it meant to lose my old family, this foundation that was so incredibly cracked in so many ways was nonetheless a foundation. And so how did I rebuild myself without that there?
You know, as you said that, I was just thinking your short stories, you know, your characters can show you the way, Liz.
Yeah.
Because that's what they seem to be doing, just kind of like taking their first steps out of collapse, life collapse. And that's interesting. I think you were prepared for that journey.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I said earlier, I believe in the redemption narrative. And I do think that, you know, we come into this world as an optimist or a pessimist. And so even though I've been through some really difficult things with my entire family dying and some the horrible circumstances that surrounded all of that, the fact that I think I am at my very core an optimist meant I wanted to be able to find a way out of that. I wanted to take that step towards rebuilding. There's a lot of people who don't. And
it's easy to get sidelined.
It is. It's
by
so,
half the stuff you mentioned, you know?
Yeah,
we're fragile beings.
We sure are.
Your stories like kind of celebrate that beautiful, humble way of just, okay.
There we go.
There we go.
With humor, you know, the women are just, you know.
Yeah, many of us are not doing huge, big, incredible, brave things. You know, we're not like, I don't know, going to Nepal and trekking up to the top of some mountain, or I so honor and appreciate people who do those incredibly brave things. You know, they go down to some war-torn country in Central America and help everyone, and those are fabulous things. But I think most of us, you know, are just trying to figure out how to be the hero of our own lives.
Oh, I like that. Well, I look forward to that memoir.
Okay.
Does it have a title yet?
Lonesome for Her Heroes. It's a line from Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl.
All right. We'll look forward to that. You know, this last spring, you published an essay. Speaking of nonfiction, you also write essays. Mm-hmm. And you published an essay that set the internet on fire. And deeply personal, mm-hmm. and brave.
Thank you.
Called The Terrible Things I Learned About My Dad, On Abuse and the People We Love. I just wonder, what has it been like as a writer to put yourself out there like that?
Yeah. That was the scariest thing I've ever put out there, because it wasn't just about me. It was about people I loved and shining a really not great light on them. And it was also about a fragility inside of me that I didn't know was there. I mean, that's how the world is, right? We don't know what can be broken until it's broken sometimes. But what really amazed me the most that I did not see coming is how many people that was going to affect. How many people were going to write to me and say, thank you for writing this. This reminds me so much of my own story, and let me tell you my own story. I've never, you know, people were telling me things they'd never told anybody ever before. And that's brave. That's fragility right there, that they were able to do that. I mean, I'm a writer. I have this tool. It's kind of my thing. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to put these truths out there. I'm supposed to be brave, you know? But the people who wrote to me, that's they didn't have to do that. And that was the thing that amazed me the most.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. I still give you props for being brave as a writer.
Oh, thank you so much.
Because it's not easy.
Well, why do it if you're not going to be brave?
You're not dealing in truth. Right?
Right? Yeah.
We're speaking with Liz Prado, Portland-based author, celebrating her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire. We're going to take a little bit of a musical break, but Liz, do you mind introducing the topic that we're going to tackle after the song break?
Oh, sure. We're going to be talking with Laura Stanfill. I really, when Leanne talked to me about coming on the program, I wanted to have a conversation. I didn't want it to just be about me. And because of that is because I didn't get here by myself. I got here because I'm part of a community, and a lot of people helped me, get to this point where I was able to publish this collection. And one of the people who's been so essential to that is Laura Stanfill, the publisher at Forest Avenue Press. And so what I really want to talk about is how writers, and specifically female writers, can help each other and in the community, because there are ways sometimes in which we don't. And so I really want to focus on the really positive things we can do to help.
All right. Thank you for that, Liz. We'll take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back with Liz Prado and Laura Stanfill.
Go and stand a while. I wanna know you're there, but I wanna be alone. If only for a minute or two. I wanna see what it feels like to be without you. Stood and looked out at the open space and a farmhouse out of ways.
That was Lucinda Williams with Side of the Road. You're listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO. For the last half hour, we've been speaking with Portland author Liz Prado, talking about her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire. Support your local booksellers and pick it up. I know it's at Powell's and Broadway Books.
And Annie Bloom's Books.
Annie Bloom's Books and Jack, my local Wallace Books, I know. So, as Liz mentioned before our song break, she would like to engage us all in a discussion about the relationships between women in the writing world, how we can and do support each other. And for that conversation, Liz has invited Laura Stanfill, founder and publisher of Forest Avenue Press, a national press based in Portland, Oregon. They publish literary fiction novels and two women-edited short story anthologies, one edited by our guest, Liz Prado, a soulful collection of stories called The Night and the Rain and the River. And there's an upcoming anthology edited by Forest Avenue Press's graphic designer, Gigi Little. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Leanne.
So, both of you, Liz Prado and Laura Stanfill, you're both very well respected and well integrated into our local writing community and beyond. And I wanted to give you a chance to share some of your experiences working with women in this writing realm.
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons I want to talk about this is because the majority of the time, it's great. It's fantastic. We're helping each other. We're coming at each other with open hearts and all that. That's like 90% of the story. About 10% of the time, something else happens. There's some jealousy or pettiness or backstabbing that goes on. And unfortunately, that smaller part gets so powerful that it overtakes all the good stuff. But there are, you know, I mean, just the fact that Laura Stanfill asked me to edit The Night and the Rain and the River, when I had no experience editing in an anthology before. I had no experience really, you know, putting anything like that together. That to me is a great example of someone reaching out and saying, okay, I'm doing this thing and I want you to do this thing with me.
Well, and Liz, the reason I picked you is because I knew you understood short stories way more than I will ever understand them, because I am a novelist and I read novels, and I loved your sensibility. I knew it was different enough from mine, but also similar enough that I would stand behind any selections you chose. And I wanted to give you that gift. I wanted to give you a byline, because you have done so much for so many writers, not just in Portland, but nationally. You're really a vocal advocate, especially for women writers. And you kind of taught me how to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I said that at Powell's when I introduced you for Babies on Fire, and I really meant it. You went out and created community and went out and joined community and created more community around what you joined and joined pieces together. And I was watching. Mm-hmm. And I understood the importance of that and wanted to be a helping hand for other people the way you were. So that's why I started my press.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because, you know, this whole thing about, oh, I went out and I did community and this and that. And some of that, when I first started out, I was very conscious about. I had no writing community and I really wanted to be a part of that. And so I knew that in some ways I was going to have to create some of it myself. But really, so much of what you guys are talking about, whatever contribution I have had, isn't something I planned. It's not something I plotted. I wasn't sitting there at home going, oh my gosh, what's my next move? You know, how am I going to, I mean, even in a positive way. I mean, a lot of it just happened naturally. You know, I met people who were excited about literature, and I introduced them to other people who were, and other people and other people. And then that just takes on an energy of its own.
So I want to get kind of specific here, Laura. You say you observed Liz Prado, you know, making community. And I know at your book launch at Powell's, it was a love fest. And it was just clear that people came out in droves to celebrate your night, because you had been
amazing
there for them. Yeah. That was the spirit of it all. So I wondered, Laura Stanfill, can you talk about what that looked like? What did you observe her doing?
Well, I met Liz around the Pinewood Table, run by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose. Mm-hmm. And she was a writer who worked really hard, and a writer who thought really hard, and a writer who was really super honest on the page all the time. Mm-hmm. She brought it. Even when it was a rough draft that maybe would never see anything in the world, she brought it. And I think she approached the desire to become part of a community and find a place in the writing world and bring other people into that place with the same amount of honesty and the same amount of brave attitude and courage and desire to not just go and forge a place for herself, but make mm-hmm. a place for all of us.
Well, you guys are painting such a rosy picture.
It's sainthood, all true.
Liz. You know, but I, you know, when I first went out there, it was scary, you know, and it's still, there's places I go into in the world, the writing world, that are scary, where I feel a little insecure and unsure of myself. And I just try and remind myself, we all feel that way. And that's a reason why, you know, I put a hand out to writers all over. I don't want other people to feel insecure and scared. I want to do what I can to be like, hey, we're all on the same team. We're supporting each other.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, when I moved to this town about 15 years ago, I was working on a novel that is now under my bed for mm-hmm. forever.
And talking that's, with that's one okay. of our, my novels under the bed, right?
I've got that's one normal. Too. Actually, I have two.
Yeah, yeah.
And the local novelist at the time, Jenny Shortridge, like, I got in touch with her. She took me out to lunch talked me through some questions I had, and that was just the beginning.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I've been pleasantly surprised with this community. It really is warm, and mm-hmm. You know, I interview authors all the time, and that's just, it's easy. Mm-hmm. You know, there aren't egos and barriers, and you know, I'm just getting my feet into some of the other arenas, like yeah. going to readings and things, and you know, kind of finding my way. But I have to say, it's very, very welcoming. And perhaps it's because I dwell a lot in the women's writing world. Mm-hmm. I can't really speak to some of the other spheres, yeah. but you know, I would say anyone listening out there, jump in, because the water's nice.
Yeah.
People are nice.
People ask me all the time, you know, young writers coming up, and by young, I don't mean like, you know, 18-year-olds. I mean, people who are just starting, what, no matter what their chronological age is, they ask me all the time, how do I create community? And I mean, there's, you know, so many ways you can do that. And okay, you can go to readings, but you have to be brave enough to turn to the person next to you and be like, hi, I'm so-and-so, or what are you reading, or what brought you here, or whatever. How, you have to be brave enough to have that conversation, and that can sometimes be hard. So, you know, one of the ways that it really happened for me was to take writing classes, because you're all in there for the same reason, you know, which is to be better writers and support each other, and you learn so much about each other. Yeah, so I don't know, people ask that question all the time, but there's all these opportunities. You just have to be willing to put yourself out there. No one's going to come to you. Although with the internet these days, you, pretty much you can, actually. You know, there's plenty of people who, because they're introverted, don't go out to readings and parties and things like that, but they are able to make pretty good connections through Facebook.
And Laura Stanfill, as the publisher and founder of Forest Avenue Press, I know you give back in your capacity as a publisher, and would you mind talking about some of the ways you give back?
Well, I founded the press because I saw a need. We talked a little bit previous to this program, Liz and I did, about the opportunities and how the economy has changed, how the literary world has changed. There just aren't as many top-tier opportunities as there used to be, with the big five publishing and the all the publishers shrinking, and even agencies are falling apart, or agents are joining other agents to minimize costs and things like that. And I just felt like, well, I have the background in PR and community outreach and design and manuscript editing, and I know this great group of writers, and I know there are so many more writers out there who deserve a place in the world for their work. And so I started Forest Avenue just kind of on a whim of wanting to bring community, wanting to make a physical product that showed how amazing this community is, this Portland writing community. And it's become national from there. It's been thrilling. I can only help a couple authors at a time in terms of publishing their novels, because we're a very small organization and I have limited time to work on major projects, but I can put together collections of stories where we can feature 25 or 30 people at one time, and then we get to introduce them to each other, and we get to form a different sort of community and grow our own community that way. And I'm also very, very careful to offer feedback whenever possible, and that includes giving advice on query letters, helping people figure out how to find an agent that's right for them, sending, certainly if there are any manuscripts that really get my attention in the submission process, I say so, and I say why, and I try to mm-hmm. say with the most kindness possible why it ended up not resonating with me. And I've gotten amazing emails from people I don't know thanking me and saying 3-4 months later after my letter, they're like, I got it now. I know what's wrong with my manuscript, and this is how I'm fixing it, and I just wanted to say thank you. And so that's a way I can reach out, which I would never have had the power to. I wouldn't have taken it on myself as a woman writer in the world, but as a woman publisher, I can share what I know in a way that I couldn't before.
You know, another woman publisher in town, Voice Catcher, those collections are edited by women, and they provide feedback too.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten some. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, my rejection was just so easy to swallow because you got this really helpful feedback that mm-hmm. you can actually use, not just that no, which, you know, then you spend your next year talking to yourself yeah. in the night. You know, I just think, thank you, Laura, I just found out that you provide feedback to your authors, too. I think that's not typical. Am I right?
No, it's not typical at all. And when I edited The Night and the Rain and the River, that was something that I was really intent on. Even if it was just a couple of lines, I wanted to say something nice about the piece, and I wanted to let them know why I wasn't able to accept the piece. You know, it didn't have to be like forever, because, you know, you'd go crazy. I mean, we had 71 submissions, so I couldn't give detailed feedback to everybody, but I wanted them to know, hey, a human being read this and recognizes there's another human being on the other side of this letter.
Mm-hmm. No, in the things to do and things not to do category, one thing not to do is to argue with an editor about how they may be misunderstood, and just because the real protagonist shows up at page 100 doesn't mean that that there's a problem with the book. It's been really interesting to deal with feedback, and I understand the frustration of being a writer on the other side of the desk, wanting a way into the club, wanting to be in the publishing arena, and they can sometimes be very, very aggressive about responding to a rejection or mm-hmm. something that was intended as helpful. And I try to coach all of my suggestions in really positive language of like, well, it caught my attention because of this. But I really love that first character, and I didn't connect with that character on page 100, who is actually the protagonist. So I've learned to let a lot of it roll off. But as Liz said earlier, 90% is great, and the 10% is what sticks sometimes. And I think as women, we need to be able to talk about that and be able to honor the bad stuff with the good stuff, and also allow us, which will then hopefully allow us to focus on that 90%.
So that let's talk a little bit about that 10% less than positive experience mm-hmm. with women. What do you think is at the heart of that competition?
Yeah, I think that there is a scarcity model, and I know that sounds kind of like a cliche, but I think there's this sense that there's only so much pie, you know, to go around. And, I think that we often feel like when we see somebody else get that really good publishing deal or a lot of attention for whatever they've written or however somebody defines success, I think it's easy to believe, well, they just took something away from me because there's only so much of it to be had. And, you know, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, there really only are so many, as Laura referred to them, top tier deals. There's only so many six figure deals out there. There's a limited number. There's only so many books that Oprah's going to pick. There's only, so many. Even like I feel incredibly lucky to have launched my book at Powell's downtown. I talked mm-hmm. to a lot of authors who have tried to get readings there and have been turned down. So I understand that in and of itself is a privilege that somebody else may feel badly about not getting for themselves. So I don't want to say, oh, it's untrue. You know, there's endless possibility, or, you know, there's endless resources for all of us. Because if that's how you're judging your success, if you're judging it on, did you have a reading at Powell's, and are you judging it on how big your advance was, and you're judging it on who your agent is and whether or not Oprah picked your book or whatever magazine, yeah, that's going to be pretty limited. But if you are judging your success on, am I working at my craft? Am I creating art? Am I creating community? That's endless. that is infinite. And that there is plenty of that to go around. And if we focus on that instead of on those other tangibles, intangibles, which frankly, we don't have a lot of control over, I think we're going to be much happier people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Cheryl Strayed could have made us all kill ourselves by now. I mean, but you just can't. I actually twist that around in my head and go, if it happened to her, yeah, it's possible. And but even that's not even I write. You know,
well, it's funny because I do just the opposite with her situation because it's so out of hand. You know? And it's like, okay, that's just never going to happen again. And that's okay, though, because that's not why I'm out there. I mean, it's wonderful that it happened to her, but that's not what, you know, it's not what I'm creating art for. If that happened, okay, that would be spectacular if my art happened to reach that many people and touch that many people. But you know, if it doesn't, that's okay too.
I think sometimes women end up having expectations of that kind of thing happening. And usually I would refer to young writers the way Liz did in terms of writers who are newer to the industry. And they think there's nothing to it. I'm going to write this book and submit it. And I'm going to get a movie deal in addition to my book deal. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't happen that way. And I think being really transparent, one of my goals as a publisher is to be able to say, look, there are small margins. There is high competition. And people are watching a lot of TV and not reading books necessarily, or they're online on social media sites. So the opportunities are limited, but let's make the most of what we have. And let's look at those and see the moment an opportunity comes our way, how we can share it with someone else. Mm-hmm. I love talking about other women who have helped me and passing the favor on. When people give me advice, especially that first year or two as a new publisher, Rhonda Hughes at Hawthorne Books was really influential. Mm-hmm. And she actually sat me down and said, okay, you need a distributor. And I was like, oh, I do. She's so much wiser than I am because she's been there for so many years and done this. And she said, this is what you need to do for your business. And I just felt that was a remarkable offhand comment to her that changed my business model. And I like to try to do the same thing to the women I know, you know, even if it's a small email about, hey, there's an agent, I know you're working on this memoir, there's an agent that might be a good fit for you, stick this in your back pocket, I saw this online. Just tiny little things.
How hard is that, just to forward an email that you think is going to help somebody else along? I mean, there's so many ways. This is one thing Laura and I were talking about. There's so many ways to help people out. One of the things Leanne and I were talking about early on is that I've kind of come to hate the term literary citizenship.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Not because of what it can mean, but because of how people have co-opted it. I think people have started using this idea of literary citizenship and building community as more of a platform and an audience building mechanism.
For themselves.
For themselves, yeah. For themselves. Like, look how many Facebook friends I have. Look how many people I connect with each other. Look how many, you know. And that's not the same thing of what we're talking about. You know, one of the things about, you know, I see all these articles about literary citizenship and it's like, go to all the readings, go to parties, go to, okay, well, you know what? Some people are horrible introverts and going to all the readings is, or you know, they have kids, you know, they just cannot leave the house every night at 7 o'clock or whatever. We all have life circumstances, whatever they are. And so there are so many different ways you can help somebody. And what Laura just said right there is like, oh, she finds out about there's this publishing opportunity for a memoir. She forwards it to this person she knows who's working on a memoir. How many seconds did that take? 10, you know, at tops. And it doesn't take that much energy away from her. So, I mean, we can all find these different ways to help each other.
One of my favorite author supporters is a writer named Deb Stone who lives here in Portland. And she, when she goes to a book event, she buys more than one book and then she gives one away on social media to somebody who would enjoy it. And it's just such... she's an amazing person anyway, but it's just that kind of small but important gesture because you're supporting the bookstore, you're supporting the author, and you're sharing it. And who knows what that book will do in the world, what good work it will do in the hands of the person who receives it.
And she's not doing that so everybody will go, look at Deb, look at Deb, look at Deb.
You know? And I think that's why it's fun to mention her on the radio.
Yeah. Because Deb, 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 Deb.
And, you know, I'm just going to say, before Cheryl Strayed got Oprah'd, She was on KBOO. She gave us 12 signed copies of her hardcover book to support our pledge drive. You know what I mean?
Oh, she was. I mean, she's one of those authors who reached out to me when I was a young author. I remember the first time I met Cheryl. There was in a 30th anniversary celebration for Annie Bloom's Books, a bookstore in Multnomah Village, and a bunch of local authors had been invited to it. And I walked into the room and I was just kind of saying hi to a few people. And Cheryl said, "Oh, hey, you're Liz Prado. Hey," because we knew each other from social media or something. She said, "Come over here, sit with us, talk." Okay, that's huge. I mean, she wasn't, you know, who she is now, huge, but she, you know, she reached out to me and was just like, "Hey, let's get to know each other. Who are you?"
These are the kind of people in our community, the kind of women writers
that
I bump into all the time.
Lydia Yuknovich is another person who does that too. She, you know, has this new novel out right now, The Small Backs of Children. And when she found out that she was getting this great two-book deal from Harper, I just happened to have coffee with her like an hour after she got off the phone with the editor at Harper. And she said to me, "Do you realize how great this is? Do you know how many doors I can open for people now with this? I've made it into New York. Maybe I can help other people get in there too now."
That was her first thought.
That was her first thought.
You know, while we're naming names, I really appreciate what Jenny Forrester does with her Unchased Readers series.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Giving platforms to women, a lot of women of color, and, you know, she has truly cares and tries to cultivate diverse audiences.
Does a great
and
job.
Readers and so check her readings are every other month, and you can connect with
there's one coming up in August, which is specifically women of color.
Do you know the date exactly?
Boy, wouldn't it be helpful if I did. I think it's August 12th, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think it is.
Is it at the
Crush,
the Regent? Is it Crush?
I think it's I'm not helpful at all.
We're blurring because Dami Shoemaker hosts Burnt Tongue readings as well. I want to mention Dami.
Yeah,
she gives voice to a lot of local writers. And also, do you guys know Samia Bashir, a professor at Reed?
I know that name. It's come up several times.
She's a poet, and she puts on an excellent Visiting Writers Reader series.
Oh, cool.
At Reed during the school year, open to the public, everyone, and she features tons of women.
That's
wonderful.
Those are my local heroines.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Anyone have anything else to say about that?
About people who are doing, I mean, there's so many people doing good in the community that if we started naming everyone, I mean, again, it's like easier to name the people who aren't, but we're not going to do that because that would be horrible. So yeah. I just want to, you know, encourage everybody to keep doing that.
You know, in just in doing simple author interviews on KBOO, I can't make a move without encountering another woman. There are women who do the promotions for books, the publishers, the schedulers.
The booksellers who get the books into the hands of readers.
Mm-hmm. And my overall impression is that we're really efficient and professional people.
Yeah.
We just make things happen.
We do make things happen.
I feel so apart from that New York realm that, you know, as a writer, fledgling, you just think, oh, that's what I'm gonna have to deal with someday. Anything good happens to me, I'm gonna have to deal with those guys or those you know, swinging doors. But that hasn't been the reality, and I just credit all of you in this town.
Well, Laura's for sure had a big part of that with opening Forest Avenue Press, that idea that in order to get a book published, you have to go deal with that New York stuff.
That's I decided initially just to publish Oregon writers, because why don't we do it for ourselves? What are we waiting for? Why are we standing there waiting for doors to open when we can open them ourselves? And I hope that that's helped inspire other people to do similar projects. And I certainly try to mentor other presses who are even younger than I am when I can, because of the people who helped me make this a business. I was going to say, I feel the same way about going national with our press. We signed with Legato Publishers Group in December, and we have a distribution company with sales reps who are out there at indie bookstores all across the country selling our books. And we have our next book, Landfall by Eleanor Bonney, going into Books a Million in Barnes & Noble, which is pretty much unheard of for a small independent press. And it's because I'm now getting that platform, that means all of my writers are going to have that platform, but also that I can speak up more. I can be louder in the world in a way that will help other people, I hope.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that. That was exciting news.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One of the things Laura and I were talking about was this metaphor of the ladder, you know, and how we're all climbing the ladder. And then, so don't just reach out your hand to the person above you, but reach out the hand to the person below you. But then we realize we're not even like really hip on the ladder analogy, because it really applies the up, above, and below. And we really like something that's a little bit more along on a continuum. You know, I'm not above anybody and nobody's below me. That's not how it works.
And there's only so much room on a ladder, which when we think about it, you had a great analogy instead of a ladder.
The Mobius strip. There is no top. There is no bottom.
And it's wiggles. Infinite.
It wiggles and it's infinite. There's room for everybody to play.
I love that. We're speaking with local author Liz Prado. Earlier in the hour, we talked about her debut short story collection, Babies on Fire. And we've been joined for the last half hour by Laura Stanfill, the founder and publisher of our love, a beloved little local press, Forest Avenue Press, that is now national. And I just see great things for you, Laura, and your press. I think you're poised to take over New York.
Thanks for all your support of all our authors. And it's nice to be here after you've featured so many of the people that I work with.
It's been a really beautiful relationship, I have to say. Laura has, for several years now, she's put out these beautiful books, and we've talked about them on Between the Covers primarily. And let's mention the upcoming interview with your author, Ellen Urbani. Is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
I am looking forward to speaking with her. And is the date Thursday the 13th?
I think that's right. 11th. The book launches on the 11th. So I
at
think
Powell's?
Powell's is August 29th. It's a Saturday, and it's at 4 p.m.
Yeah, that book has great press so far. It's everywhere, and it hasn't even come out yet.
One thing that Laura and I were talking about, because we want to focus on really positive things that women can do to help each other in the publishing industry, and I kind of hate the word industry, but you know, in the writing world, let's call it the writing world. Here's something you can do. When you're at a function, when you cross the room to talk to somebody, cross the room not to talk to the person who's famous or you think is going to help your career in some way, but cross the room to talk to that writer who maybe doesn't know anybody. You know, and the same thing, it's really easy to promote the book of someone on Facebook who's famous. Promote the writing of somebody who's not so much. What you're going to get back from that is in spades. That person's going to grow, and that person's going to see, look, somebody reached out to me, and they're going to continue to do that as they're coming up, because that's why I do it, because all these writers were incredibly generous to me and continue to be so. I mean, really, I just have this little short story collection on a little press. You know, it's not like I'm the king of the world or anything like that. Just continue to, like, don't think so much in terms of, you know, who makes me look good, who promotes my work, who promotes my world. Think about, who can I help?
Yeah, that's the old paradigm,
right?
That's
so
out.
Icky.
Yeah, it's so image oriented too, and we're all just trying to do good work, and we need to focus on that and help the people whose good work hasn't been heard as much as the bestsellers.
Yeah.
Thank you, Liz Prado. Thank you, Laura Stanfill.
Thank you, Leanne.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you all for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Liz Prado and her excellent book, Babies on Fire, you can go to her website, Liz Prado, PRATO.com, and do check out the Forest Avenue Press site. It's a really good website, and it's ForestAvenuePress.com. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. Thank you for being our guests. And thank you, Brooke and Michelle, for your engineering tonight.
Woo-hoo.
We're going to go out with a Lucinda Williams song, Change the Locks. Good night, everybody.
Lock on my front door so you can't see me anymore. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Symphony, presenting an evening with indie folk troubadour Grigory Allen Isakoff, Thursday, January 14th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Tickets and information for Grigory Allen Isakoff with the Oregon Symphony are available at orsymphony.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the MLK Dream Run, the weekend of August 1st and August 2nd. The 5, 10, and 15K runs will take you through the charming and historic retail, residential, and parkscapes of the Seoul District. The run and weekend events include music, food, and entertainment after the run and exist to honor Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered in Washington, D.C., August 1963, during the March for Jobs.